Sunday group, what's the difference between birth and death? So the way we usually look at that is there's a big difference, right? Here I am, and then I don't know. But clearly this isn't here. But my answer was, with the Heart Sutra, which we're going to maybe finish today, says maybe there's not so much difference. We have this huge fear because there's birth, life, and then there's death. And what the Heart Sutra is trying to say is maybe it's one. Maybe it's one thing. It's a continuum. So I was reading a thing by Suzuki Roshi, and somebody asked him that question in Tassajara, what's birth and death? And he said, well, he says, we know that things don't just end. And that's, he left it at that. And that's always been enough for me. I don't know what that is when I don't end, but I know that something will continue. And that's enough for me to see and have more of a sense of what that continuum is. And that's what the Heart Sutra is trying to teach us. It's trying to help us with our fears, you know, and our suffering. So maybe you could open to, I think it's page 2. I'm going to give you, we've just spent about 6 hours. In fact, I think I've driven a few people away because this is pretty esoteric stuff. The Heart Sutra is pretty esoteric teaching. And, you know, it's a synthesis of 500 or 600 years of meditation practice before this sutra was written. And some people like things a little more practical. But this is very practical. It's very philosophical, but it's very practical, too. So let me go through, in about 3 minutes, 5 minutes, what we've spent about 6 hours doing, which is on the website. Most of this is on the website. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. So this is the archetypal bodhisattva who alleviates suffering. Here's the cries, here's our suffering in response, and is responding with this sutra. Is practicing Prajnaparamita, which is what we're practicing when we sit. Doesn't feel that way, but we are. We're watching our mind come, and we're watching our minds go. We're beginning to deepen our insight into the impermanence of the physical mental phenomena. Clearly saw that the aggregates are empty, meaning those things that make us up. Form, feelings, perceptions, things that formulate our personality, sees that they're all empty. They just float. Don't hang on to them. The thoughts that come up, don't fix an identity around them. Let them go. Let them go. See that they're empty. See that the solid sense of self is not so solid. If you can do that, you can alleviate your sense of separateness from things. And that alleviates suffering. And thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Shariputra is one of the disciples. And I don't need to get into why he's addressing Shariputra. But so what we think is heaven, this ethereal state up there, or even enlightenment, is no different than our everyday life. It's this very life. This form that we're in, this body, is where it's at. It's not some heaven in the sky or even some state of enlightenment. It's right here is where we find our practice. The wave is not different than the ocean. Ice is not different from water. We identify with the ice, but it's really water. Form itself is emptiness. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Exactly what we just said before. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. That means everything, not only thoughts, but everything is marked by emptiness. Is marked by this interconnectedness, this impermanence. They neither arise nor cease. Everything that arises ceases. Everything that ceases arises. Neither defiled or pure. That's the hardest one for people. Not good or bad. So on an absolute level, good does not exist without bad. You need to have bad elements. You cannot have Buddha without non-Buddha elements.
So remember, we're looking at two different levels. We're looking at the absolute level. This is giving us the absolute perspective, which everything is perfect. Because it is. It's perfect because it is. And on a relative level, there is suffering. And we need to address specifically suffering. If you abide too much in the absolute, you don't have enough compassion for suffering. If you abide too much in suffering, you burn out. You don't see the big picture. You need to merge both the absolute and the relative. This picture gives you more the absolute because we abide so much in the relative. It's trying to lift you up from a different perspective. So neither defiled nor pure. At some level, you need to practice the precepts, but at another level, bad is connected with good. They neither increase or decrease, which we just said. Therefore, given emptiness, this interconnectedness, and this impermanence, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formations, no consciousness, which is just what we said before. They're not separate things, which is what the early Buddhists thought. They're just all connected. The eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight. Yes, there are those things, but those things are also connected with the outside. So the difference between inside and outside blur. It isn't like that's out there and I'm in here, which is really what we objectify the world. This is blurring that distinction. You are creating the world by how you think and feel about it. This is what this is saying. No sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no logic, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. So those of you, these are called the 18 dot twos. It just means that they're all connected. And I lectured about that more specifically. Then, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. So that's what we talked about last time. The 12-fold chain of codependent origination, where you start with ignorance and then you formulate into the human consciousness and you go around to the end where there's birth and then there's death. There's a cycle. And what they're saying is, it's not that those don't exist, it's just that they all interpenetrate. They all are conditioned on one another. Then it goes in, which we'll talk about today. There's no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. Well, I thought the whole path was about attainment. I thought that's what early Buddhism said. It's all about attaining nirvana, getting from the state of ignorance to a state of non-ignorance. That's what early Buddhism, for 500 years, that's where people were going. This seems to be saying, no, there's something more than that. You can give that drive, that impulse that I'm no good and I've got to get to somewhere else that's better. So let's study that a little bit. That's where we left off. So it's basically saying we're all, it's denying all these basic premises that Buddhism had been saying up to 500 years. So this why this is so radical. So it doesn't mean that emptiness doesn't mean nothing. That's not a good definition. Better definition is like boundlessness. It just means that things do not exist. They just things exist in a fundamentally different way than we think they do. For example, we think this is a bell and it's solid. But particle physics teaches us that if you just keep going deeper into this, we don't even come to an end of it. It's just energy. That's pretty hard for us to understand that. But that's what physics teaches us. That's what this is teaching us. The Heart Sutra is saying is if you keep going deeper with your consciousness, you begin to see things in a fundamentally different way. You don't see things as fixed and separate and independent. You don't see them as solid and fixed, like your points of view or your personality. You begin to see them as a flow and all full of connection. Everything, all you see is connection. The more you practice prajna, all you see is connection. Connection. Even between good and bad, you see connection. So now we get to the Four Noble Truths. It says here, no suffering, no cause. So that's the Four Noble Truths. There's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's elimination of suffering, and there's the Eightfold Path. So let's just talk about that for a minute. So the first noble truth is suffering. So Buddhism kind of gets a bad rap around that because clearly there's a lot of joy, right, in life, and there's a lot of happiness in life. So it's not saying that. In fact, one of the empowerments is like joyfulness comes from practice. But it just says that there's an underlying anxiety that we have, that even joy we know is going to end. And we know that we're going to end. We know, even though we deny it, that we're going to die. And that creates an existential anxiety. That things are impermanent and we want them desperately to be permanent, right? We don't want to let go of people we love. We don't want to let go of our body, our health. But fundamentally, all that's going to change. And that creates a huge sense of anxiety for us. That's what the first noble truth was. Okay. The second noble truth is that there's a way around this. First, when Buddhism first started, it was more about desire. What created suffering was desire. We wanted sensual desire. We wanted money, we wanted sex, we wanted power. That's what created suffering. But as Buddhism began to develop, become more sophisticated, they saw that what was really creating suffering was this existential anxiety, that things were impermanent, and we just didn't want to let go of things. In some ways, the desire also for things to be different than the way they are. We want things to be different than the way they are, and that also creates a lot of suffering. We want things to last. So the way around this, suffering and the cause of suffering, there's only one way around this. And that was the third noble truth. And the third noble truth is you've got to deeply see that everything's impermanent. That in fact, everything is going to change. And in fact, that your separateness is not separate. That you're connected with everything. And everything is connected with you. That's a pretty deep order. But that's our job. That's the job of the Bodhisattva. That's the practice of Prajnaparamita, is to do that. So that is the way out. And then how you do that is for the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is, one, is right view. Right view just really means to understand the interconnectedness, not the independence of things, but the interdependence. That's right view. Number two, sometimes it's called understanding, or I like it better, intention. Your intention is to try to see that, to try to practice your life in a way to see that. Number three is right action, which means you've got to practice the precepts. You can't see that if you're out killing and stealing and lying. It doesn't work. And then number four is very practical. Is right speech. Speech is very important because, as we say in our precepts, we create and destroy worlds with our speech. Speech is very important. Number five is right livelihood. If you are trying to rip people off, you know, and are too self-centered or killed, that's not right livelihood. It's going to create bad karma. So that leaves us to number did I leave one? Right livelihood. Then let's see, number six, I think I left one out. Is, again, right effort in the sense that you see the karmic implications of how you think. Six, seven, and eight have to do with meditation. Six is like you see how your mind creates karma. Wholesome thoughts, unwholesome thoughts create karma. Number seven is right mindfulness. You practice meditation. You practice being aware of your thoughts, aware of the body sensations, aware of your interaction with other people, interaction with how you move, how you walk, right? Mindfulness. Number eight and last is right concentration, which I mentioned earlier, which meant more the absorptions in early Buddhism. The mind calms down enough, you sit still enough, or you calm enough to see that in fact things are impermanent, that your thoughts are impermanent. You have a deep penetration into the reality, and that brings you back to number one again, which is right view, that everything is interdependent. So that's the Eightfold Path. What this is saying, it doesn't say that that doesn't exist. It's just saying that they're all connected and that you have to, and this is what's so beautiful about the Heart Sutra. Most religious doctrines are dogmatic. They say, here are the Ten Commandments, practice the Ten Commandments, or you're going to hell. Right? This says, these are provisional guidelines. Don't make a dogma out of them. They're all related to something else. Don't go to war over that this is the truth. What the Heart Sutra is saying is that whatever you say about anything is provisional. It can be helpful, but it's provisional, including the idea of emptiness, including the idea of Buddhism. It's just provisional. It's just, don't lighten up around it. Which is a great way to practice religion, isn't it? I mean, it's just so liberating. So that's what it's saying. It's not saying, that there isn't any suffering. It's just saying, see it in a different way. See that these concepts are provisional and that they're all interconnected. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, see, like in the second noble truth, the second Eightfold Path, right understanding, the right intention, is made up of, this is his quote, is made up of non-understanding elements. So, I'm going to read you, because the next part is a little bit more, even more complicated than what I was saying, so I just want to read you how Norman Fisher talks about this, which I think he does very eloquently. Where he says here, no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path. Well, I thought that's why we're here, because we're on a path, right? No knowledge and no attainment. This is pretty radical statements here. And no attainment, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. So when you think about what is nirvana, what is enlightenment, what do we really want? We want peace, don't we? We want to be at rest. And how do you get to be at rest? Well, do you just work real hard, and then suddenly you get perfect? And then finally you're at peace? I mean, actually, we do believe that. We all really think that that's the way we should practice our religion. And we can't totally let go of that, or otherwise you probably wouldn't show up, or you wouldn't do your meditation practice. But this is saying, in our meditation practice, we can be free. We can liberate ourselves right now. In this moment, you can liberate yourself. So here's what Norman has to say. Because in emptiness, all concepts are just provisional concepts, we could say that attainment, as long as we realize that cognitions are just designations, mere provisional statements that have no fundamental reality. So yes, there are, but on the level of actual reality, no, there isn't. So bodhisattvas depend on the Four Noble Truths. Bodhisattvas do not depend on the Four Noble Truths. The bodhisattvas depend on prajnaparamita. So this was a big shift from early Buddhism to later Buddhism. We're now depending mostly on this prajnaparamita, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom. This wisdom that really appreciates the empty nature of phenomena, a wisdom that falls off the end of wisdom as wisdom, would be wisdom about something. That the wisdom about something, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a transcendental wisdom. This is a recognition that there is nothing to be wise about. That everything just is. There is nothing to be wise about. There's no even some enlightenment you've got to get. That everything just is. And the Bodhisattva just is. So anything that I say about it is wrong. Any expression is always misleading. Now that's the hardest part for people to know. Whatever I say about anything is provisional. It's only partially the truth, including Buddhism or enlightenment or anything I just said. It's just a provisional statement. And you have to look at it more in that framework. Not to discount it, but just to see that it's a concept and it's provisional. The Bodhisattva just depends on Prajnaparamita. Just connects with everything without a single obstruction anywhere. So how could there be any hindrance? There's no hindrance because you're just in Prajnaparamita and you're just connecting. And in some ways you're just accepting everything as it is. Now that sounds very far out, right? But isn't that really what's happening when you're at peace? When your mind stills and you stop dividing things? And you're just there. And maybe that feeling only lasts for a few minutes. Isn't that exactly what's happening? And maybe if that feeling is deep and profound enough, that will carry over into your whole life. More and more into your whole life. That even when you do divide, in the back of your mind, you know that you don't need to divide things up. Because everything is just unfolding in this vast and wonderful framework of emptiness. So this is where the mystery of practice comes in, where the limitation of language comes in. You can't describe this. This is beyond language. That's why we meditate, because that's the way you access it, is you can't talk about it and get it through just verbal. So then it goes on and says, without hindrance, there is no fear. You're just there. If you're there and you're just accepting everything, including your death, or the boundary between birth and death, there's no fear. You're just accepting reality as it's coming to you. So you're free of concepts. What would it be like to be totally free of concepts? The concept that you're there, you're different than me. The concept that I'm right and you're wrong. That my point of view is right and your point of view is wrong. What would that be like to be really more free of those kinds of concepts? What would the world be like? So, can we really live like this? Yes and no. Yes, we can. Because it's true. The Prajnaparamita is true. This is, well, provisionally it's true. Right? It's true. But no, we are conditioned beings. So, where this puts us is that as conditioned beings, we do fear death. We have some fear of death. We have some fear of pain. We experience suffering. But, if we can practice Prajnaparamita, it will help us a lot. It will help us not be so fearful of losing our health, not so fearful of death, and not so fearful of pain. So when people are taking pain control meditation at all these hospitals, they don't understand they're practicing the Prajnaparamita, but they are. They're practicing, noticing that their pain comes and goes, isn't as solid, abates, is intense one moment, but isn't. They don't know. They've never heard of Buddhism. But that's what they're learning. And does it totally eliminate pain? No. But they've proved that it will back off your pain 20-30% if you really practice this with pain in your body. It does help. And the more and the deeper you penetrate the practice, the more that it does help. So now we get down. What happened now? The Heart Sutra was a condensation of these 18 volumes of Prajnaparamita literature into these 32 lines. Then after a couple hundred years, they added this last part here because then Buddhism got into sort of mantra practice. They wanted to condense it even further, so they condensed it into just a mantra. You know, kind of like Om, Mani Padme, Om, Om. You know, you've all heard that mantra, right? Well, you could say that that mantra condenses all of Tibetan practice, which is, you know, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, or the Buddha nature inside me, which is the inside you. That's what that mantra means, Om Mani Padme Om. So it says here, therefore know, the Prajnaparamita is the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra. So they're adding this on at the end. They're saying, what we just said here is, you know, get with it. This is important to practice it. This is the incomparable mantra which removes all suffering and is true, not false. Oh, I forgot one thing before this. Without hindrance, all Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on Prajnaparamita. So that means all Buddhas before the historical Buddha, all the Buddhas that exist now, you don't have to call them Buddhas. You could call them Methodist ministers or rabbis. That state of mind, that seat, you could call it Christ. That state of mind that sees the universality of things, sees the interconnection, sees the deep ecology of everything. All those people, all the Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on Prajnaparamita. And past, present, and future, it usually says the three realms. Well, I won't get into a discussion of that, but anyway. So therefore know the Prajnaparamita as the great miraculous mantra, great bright mantra, supreme mantra, incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering and is true, not false. So part of this kind of accelerates your interest. The other part always feels a little fundamental to me. You know, like this is the real truth or something, which is just told you that you have to hold everything in a provisional way of looking at it. Therefore we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra that says, Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhisattva. So what that basically means is, the translation, gone, Gati, gone, gone. Gone far beyond your conventional way of thinking of things. Gone far beyond pure presence. This place in your meditation where you're just present every minute, accepting every minute as it is. Bodhisattva. Hallelujah. Gone, 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 beyond, gone, far beyond. Hallelujah. That's what that means. So traditionally, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, in the ceremony when people die, you chant the Heart Sutra. And then at the end, you chant that 108 times in the body, you know, right after the body, soon after the person has passed, you're chanting that 100 times. Gate, gate, para, gate, parsam, gate, bodhisattva, gate, gate, para, gate, parsam, gate, bodhisattva, gate, gate, para. That, so you're sending off whatever there is. We don't know what that is, but whatever is being sent off, we're trying to help it being sent off. So Suzuki Rishi says, the world is its own magic. The world is empty of separateness. That's the magic. The feeling, the magic of how the world really is all the time, and not dependent on any state of mind. This is the real magic. Magic is vague, mysterious. You can't define it. It has to remain this way, kind of vague, empty. Even better not to answer these questions. Just find out in your own meditation practice. That's why so much of Zen teaching, the Buddha would answer, or the teachers would answer with silence, because anything I say is going to be provisional. It's going to, you know, is there birth after death? The Buddha didn't say anything, because whatever he said yes, well, then he comes down on the side of some extension. If he says no, it means that things end right now. So he just was silent. So, when we say, there's a famous saying in Zen, everyday mind is the way. And that's very hard for people because our mind is so confused and so busy. How could that be the way? Right? Clearly it's some mind that's calm and centered and quiet. That must be the mind. But no, everyday mind is the way. And so when we sit down with everyday mind, how do you think we find out that form, feeling, perception, impulses, and consciousness are empty? By working with our everyday mind. So we're back down to everyday mind. So we sit without some sense of that we're going to get something else. We sit without some gain-seeking mind. We just sit in this prajna with some faith that it's helpful and that things can unfold. So we just finished about 6 hours of Paramita.